Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week is the co-head of North American Core Senior Lending at our very own HPS Investment Partners. This gentleman was born and raised in Indiana and graduated high school in Elkhart, Indiana, a town he is fond of saying is the RV capital of the world. He attended Indiana University, where he majored in finance, and then post-college started in the credit and capital markets business at Bank One, where a guy you may know named Jamie Dimon was the CEO. After the merger with J.P. Morgan, he came over to the leveraged finance group in J.P. Morgan in New York, where, true story, he sat right next to our co-head of Core Senior Lending, former HPS cast guest Grishma Parekh. In 2008, he moved internally within J.P. Morgan to join the new buy-side credit business of Highbridge. That business became HPS when it was spun out from J.P. Morgan in 2016, and he's worked here ever since. In 2013, he had returned to America's heartland, starting up our new Chicago office, and has been instrumental in the growth and success of our Core Senior Lending product from its inception. He's a colleague, but he's also a friend and someone I legitimately enjoy working with on a day-to-day basis. So without any further ado, I'm very excited to welcome in person into the HPS studios this week's HPS cast guest, Mike Fenstermacher, a.k.a. Fenster, co-head of North American Core Senior Lending at HPS. Mike, welcome to the pod.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, Fenster, let's go all the way back. You moved around a bit, it sounds like, growing up, but generally in the Indiana area?
Yeah. If it's north of Indianapolis, I'm probably familiar with it.
Fair enough. All right. So college, you decided to go to Indiana undergrad. Why was that the right choice for you?
Cost. It was a good value. My dad actually had done undergrad and actually grandfather both done undergrad at Indiana.
You decide to study finance and business undergrad. Why was that the right choice for you?
I was interested in how businesses made money. There's not too many people in my family that are business oriented. And so for me, I gravitated towards the opposite and was interested in how businesses made money and how they financed themselves.
You rebelled from your family and became a credit investor. I love it. So you graduated in 2002. Tell me about how you found your first job at Bank One.
The interview process back in 2002, there was no real investment banking focus at Indiana University. There is now. It's quite successful. At the time, the top jobs were either with a commercial bank or with a big four accounting firm. And so I gravitated towards the bank recruitment process and ended up at Bank One.
And tell me what Bank One was in the early 2000s.
Largely a commercial bank. They had some capital markets businesses. They were a lender with a lot of various commercial lines of lending, frankly. But mostly it was Columbus, Ohio, originally headquartered. And Jamie Dimon had come post his tenure at Citigroup and really kind of revolutionized the bank, oriented it more towards an upmarket and growth posture.
So you'd migrated towards business and finance. You talked about the appeal of commercial banking, but why? You know, relative to other options, you could have gone into corporate America. You could have done other things. What was it about banking that had a draw for you?
It was the diversity of experiences and liking to see something new kind of every day.
Tell me about what you took away from your early experiences then in commercial banking.
A lot of it was just hardcore credit. There was a credit camp that we actually went off-site to go through. They actually did like a mock industrial plant tour.
Amazing.
One of the credit officers of the bank was pretending to be a manager that was trying to get you to ignore OSHA violations and chemical spills in the background of the hotel that they'd turned into this manufacturing plant.
I love it. And then, so tell me about that role. So you get hired into the credit and capital markets group. What precisely did you get hired to do day one?
Really, it was underwriting credits, automotive dealerships, frankly, looking at their cash flows, making sure that they could support the level of debt that we were going to be providing them. You're getting into people's personal finances as well, because a lot of times there'd be personal guarantees on those lines.
All right. So we're into 04. J.P. Morgan and Bank One merge, as I mentioned. What does that mean for a young Fenstermacher?
Initially, I think a lot of people were scared, frankly, that J.P. Morgan will basically subsume Bank One and there'll be no opportunities for people. And so there was definitely a lot of hand-wringing and people not being really sure what was going to happen. I would give Jamie Dimon credit because he frankly gathered everybody in a large auditorium and kind of listed out like, that's not what's happening here. And they basically very quickly set about a process by which people could begin interviewing for new opportunities, or that there would still be obviously a robust Bank One still doing what they've been doing for years.
So you get the opportunity at that point, despite your better efforts, to come to New York City. What was it about the opportunity in New York that was appealing for you?
You know, by then I frankly had gotten a better appreciation for what an investment banking role would be versus a commercial banking role. And that excited me. Again, it was even a greater breadth of experiences, a higher volume of opportunities to be looking at. And from my perspective, and I tell this to junior people as I coach them through the early stages of their career, there's no replacement for seeing a large, diverse set of opportunities to then be able to draw from later in your career. So you want to go to where you can see the most opportunities and get the largest breadth of experiences possible.
Makes total sense. So you moved to New York. Tell me about the group you joined. What was the JP Morgan business that you joined at that point?
Unbeknownst to me, it was the number one leveraged finance underwriter out there, both in high yield bonds and leveraged loans. And coming in 2004, it was the upswing of an LBO boom. So for the better part of the 4 years that I was there, there was a high degree or a high volume of leveraged finance, leveraged buyouts by sponsors, and was really coming in and doing a lot of cash flow modeling, a lot of debt sensitivity, obviously taking a view on valuation and the credit quality of firms, but also having a mindset of, can we sell this to investors? Like an understanding what investors want and in a deal and how they want those deals structured.
Who was your favorite JP Morgan colleague and why was it Grishma Parekh?
I was going to say, it's a very loaded question. Grishma and I always joke, we both met each other when we were children and now we both are raising our own children, which is a little odd.
Horrifying. Yeah.
If you would have told me 15 or 16 years ago when we met that would be where we'd end up, I would have said you're crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you were like 25 or whatever was working together. Now you're running a business together. It's fun looking back.
Yeah. And I would say this, it's very easy for us to be real with each other because
you've known each other long enough.
There's no secrets.
Well, and it's funny, we've interviewed a number of people on the podcast who are co-heads or co-CEOs or things like that. And I find the most successful pairings like that are people who really know and trust each other. And you can't just snap your fingers and create. That takes time to get right. So I've always loved that. Okay, let's fast forward. So it's April 2008. There are some cracks in the macro foundation, but the world hasn't quite fallen apart yet with the global financial crisis. JP Morgan had just bought Bear Stearns. Lehman didn't file bankruptcy until the fall of 2008. You get a chance to move internally to Highbridge, which was then part of JP Morgan Asset Management. Tell me about the pitch. Like when you first heard of this principal strategies business at Highbridge, what did they sell you on and why was it compelling?
You know, it's taking principal risk, buy and hold versus taking a viewpoint for 60 or 90 days of market risk. It's, do you want to live with this investment until maturity or till realization? And the idea of getting deeper and frankly, being incentivized to dig in and form a proprietary view that was supported by firsthand diligence was highly attractive to me versus just telling the story that a client was paying you to tell.
Yeah. And you have to live with your decisions, as you say. You're going to be with this stuff for a while.
It's a way to really learn.
That's right. Right? That's right. So again, who did you meet with? We've interviewed governing partners of HPS. When you first were doing this, who were you chatting with about it?
I believe there was only 12 employees at the time. So the answer is everybody.
Yeah.
Like my case study, which I believe was Harris Entertainment, was the entire firm was sitting around the table.
So Kapnick, Pernima, French, Patterson, like literally?
I believe Kapnick may have been traveling that day, but everybody else. Scott, amazing. Pernima, everybody. So it was very daunting. And they frankly, I think they'd just put the position on. So yeah. It was even more so daunting as we were with my recommendation of not investing due to document quality was my fear due to baskets for additional debt was, let's just say it was somewhat uncomfortable because I found out halfway through that they had put on the investment.
Yeah. Coaching for any young listeners out there. Anytime I ask you to do a case study and it turns out that's in their portfolio, it's high risk. You got to be careful. Okay. So you join, you are therefore in this investing seat at Highbridge when the 2008 financial crisis hit. Tell me what that experience was like.
Again, like the moment where we found out JP Morgan was buying or merging with Bank One, it was scary, right? And that for person, I'd never seen a cycle like that. The dot-com bubble burst when I was graduating college. And so to actually be in a seat where you actually have fiduciary duty to people in that economic environment and trying to see your way through the fog and take the opportunity where it exists or avoid the pitfalls where they may be is harrowing. And so I would say at the very earliest stage of our formation as a firm, the emphasis on diligence, the emphasis on checking, double checking, triple checking your work, bringing all the resources and relationships of the firm to bear to help hone that analysis and pressure test things like, your favorite question, who buys this firm if this goes sideways? You know, that question's been getting asked since 2008. And it's an important question because it begets a lot of other good questions.
Yeah. I always ask people what lessons they learned. That was mine. When things go wrong, who's actually going to buy it? We're in the midst of a volatile environment today, which we'll get to later. But are there experiences that you had in 08, 09 living through that, that you carry with you to today to educate how you're going to handle the situation?
Absolutely. Looking back on it, you realize you may have, due to fear, you didn't take risk that you should have. You know, in retrospect, you say, boy, I should have done those two deals for sure. And so now as we see, there's a lot of volatility and that can feel very scary at times. You realize like part of our job is we don't do risk-free rate, right? We do take and manage risk. And to have a sense of over the 15 years as a firm, we've been doing this, this is an opportune time to be putting on risk in a judicious way and to be obviously still double checking your work, but to make sure that we don't miss opportunities just because it feels scary.
Yeah, I think there's no substitute for having lived through that because you can never really understand how you can react. People have heard me say this before. I love the Mike Tyson quote, everybody has a plan until they're punched in the face. We all got punched in the face in 08, 09. And there's two things that you need to do. You need to manage your own risk and understand what's happening in your portfolio. But as you said, that's an incredible opportunity to judiciously find opportunities to put money to work, which we've seen post-COVID and we're seeing now. Okay, so if you fast forward then a couple more years post that, Mike, you end up moving back to Chicago. Why was the Chicago office important for HPS at that point?
Yeah. In terms of Chicago, and there are certainly in the middle market direct lending space, a number of competitors with presence out there. There's also a number of our best sponsor clients of the firm that have headquarters there. So the idea being twofold. One, I would obviously return to my roots and be closer to family, but also have the opportunity to both expand our market share and also tap into a talent pool. There's a rich talent pool within Chicago of people with very good training that have come up on the credit side that we've been able to add onto the team as we've gone.
Having done both, how different is it working in a regional office versus the main corporate headquarters?
I think the important thing is to try to keep a consistent culture. And I think as I was leaving New York, I got a distinct feeling that it was on me to make sure communication was kept up, you know, and I think that is the key. What's interesting now is post-COVID,
I
think
curious we all got a taste. If the answer has changed, yeah.
Yeah, I think it took a lot of effort to be a regional office before COVID, right? Because people weren't accustomed to dialing somebody in or doing a Zoom call or working over a share drive. I think through COVID, I think geographic location has become less important. I think it's extremely important to be with your colleagues, right, routinely. But I think the ability to be flexible around the edges of when you're really cranking on an assignment, being able to do that from anywhere has been enhanced.
So let's take a step back. Within direct lending as an asset class at HPS, we divide it into what we call SLF, specialty loan finance, and core senior lending, CSL. You, as we've discussed, are one of the co-heads of CSL. What is CSL and what does it do?
Yeah, from our perspective, it's looking for the highest quality borrowers, businesses with scale, and opportunities that we feel confident in the sector trends and the positioning within that sector for that particular borrower, and then supporting those businesses through whatever it may be, whether it be a buyout financing or if it's a non-sponsored company or public companies, and sometimes helping them make acquisitions with debt financing. From our perspective, it is trying to reduce the volatility, right?
Okay. So then if you think big picture about private credit, we'll come to more current volatile credit markets. But in a normal functioning credit market, which the majority of our HPS time has been in, why would a borrower opt for a direct lending solution versus just a traditional broadly syndicated solution?
Yeah. And I think we saw even ahead of the dislocation that we felt this year in 2022 and 2021, I think there were something like 29 you know, what we'll call like billion-dollar plus tranche deals that were done in the private market. So even ahead of some of the dislocation, there was an attraction by borrowers to, you know, if you think about it, a lot of people within direct lending have scaled up from a size perspective. The notion of getting a $2 or $3 billion deal done in the private market might have taken 15 calls 5 years ago, but now you can do that in 3 or 4 calls. And I think there's a real attraction to a sponsor to deal with the 3 or 4 lenders who are actually going to hold the risk and form that mindset view of it versus somebody that's underwriting to distribute. And then they also are still going to have some level of market risk on the terms they're receiving from the lenders.
So said a different way, 5 years ago, if you wanted to get $1 billion financing done, you had to go broadly syndicated route. You'd call your old friends at JP Morgan, they'd raise it and they'd syndicate it out. And if it was hard to syndicate, they might change the terms on you and make it a worse deal for the borrower, better deal for the lender. These days, you can do that directly with a couple or even in some cases, one direct lender. And that speed and certainty of execution is part of the appeal.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think also there's a level of sophistication on the direct lender side. Not that we may not ask some questions that might annoy a borrower, but generally we're very knowledgeable in the sectors we lend in. So when we're having conversations with our management teams of companies we're going to lend money to, it's not uncommon for them to comment on our depth of knowledge pre-existing the conversation.
And it streamlines the process, right?
Yeah. It streamlines the process. But also importantly, there are times when we're in the dialogue with the management team or adding value to them, giving them our own perspectives on a sector, which I think is also valued.
So that's the good news. Are there any disadvantages for a borrower to go the direct lending route?
I would say if you're a borrower, there is leverage to be gained over a diverse set of lenders where none of them have real control, and you have a prisoner's dilemma situation where if there's an issue with the credit and you have 40 lenders, none of which hold more than 5% of a credit, the negotiating leverage that you have is tremendous. And in some cases, there are syndicated loan docs that prevent a lender from even finding out who the other lenders are. Like, that is a legal term in the syndicated market that says you cannot see the register of lenders.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating point. I mean, part of the degradation of broadly syndicated debt documents, you know, there's been a lot of financial press spilled about how weak broadly syndicated documents are. And I think it's the power of a single point of decision making versus distributed, right? If you have a single private equity sponsor who's raising the money and 100 people they're going out to, you get very lowest common denominator thinking and end up with much worse docs than if it's one negotiating against one or two people who can sort of hold the line on important terms. All right. So we're recording this in the fall of 2022. We've got ubiquitous inflation across every virtual line item in the cost bar, and banks have pulled back on lending. What does that environment mean for the direct lending opportunity set?
You know, I think, again, first principles, like making sure you're doing your own work and not underthinking any level of risk. I think the things that we are morphing into our analyses right now, or that we're adding to our analyses, are like kind of unheard of 3 or 4 years ago, and thinking of a Europe without natural gas.
I mean, we said this the other day. We were looking at a business, a manufacturing company in Germany, whose energy costs had gone up 5x year over year. That wasn't in your risk factor last year when you were trying to think about what could go wrong with that business, per your point.
No, absolutely. And then also just the currency volatility is another item that I think people took for granted, certain levels of bands of volatility that are now getting breached. And so that you just have to work that much harder to make sure you're not, again, going back to the we don't do risk-free rate.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that we don't take risk, it's that you at least are aware of it.
Going
and you
eyes
can
wide open.
Yeah. Mitigate it in some form or fashion.
What are you seeing in terms of your opportunity set for your business these days?
We're certainly seeing, from my perspective, a higher quality pipeline. And I think that's
higher quality business, or what do you mean by that?
Both business and economic terms.
Yeah.
But first on the business, I feel in this environment of uncertainty, I think buyers of businesses are only focusing on where they have a thesis, right? Like sponsors that have a thesis on two sectors that no matter what volatility we're going through right now, they see something in that sector for the next 5 or 10 years, and they're very excited about it, excited enough to buy it in an unprecedented market that's trading off.
You're not going to stretch for a mediocre business in this kind of environment, per your point.
Correct. Yeah. Or we've seen on our pipeline, there's a lot of take privates, right? With the equity markets trading off, businesses that previously nobody would have thought are candidates to be taken private are now candidates to be taken private due to their valuations and where they've traded. I was saying to somebody, if we saw 20 things in a week and a half or 2 weeks last year, we might think two or three were kind of interesting from both quality of business and then the economic terms we thought we could achieve in the market. Now we may see 10 to 12, but geez, 8 to 10 are kind of interesting.
Well, and it's per your earlier conversation, right? In a world in which the banks have pulled back on lending, suddenly like high caliber businesses of scale that lending market offers generally is really appealing. And that lets you actually migrate up in terms of business quality, which from our perspective, given the uncertain environment, is incredibly appealing.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that.
All right. So you're the co-head of North America Core Senior Lending, but you sit on a global investment committee. The majority of what we do is North America, but we invest obviously in Western Europe and Australia, New Zealand as well. Are there particular regions or geographies you're more versus less excited about in the coming years?
You know, the Australian market's always been highly interesting to me. You know, I think there's just, you know, they're very interesting things that come out of Australia, and I think that that's not going to change. And I think the question will be, as we move forward through the next 6 months of volatility, you know, what happens in the European markets? You know, do they become less competitive? You would think through more economic uncertainty, you actually may have an environment where there could be more attractive opportunities over there than we may have seen the last 12 months.
Fair enough. All right, great. Exciting stuff, Mike. It's always good to catch up on what you guys are up to in CSL. Before we go to the final part of the podcast, I want to do a speed round. I'm going to ask you simple questions. First thought, best thought. You ready, Fenster?
We'll see.
All right. Favorite Chicago sports team to watch live?
Chicago Cubs.
All right. So what's your single favorite memory then of going to a Cubs game?
That would have to be game 3 of the World Series, where I was able to take both my dad and both my grandpas, who were still living at the time.
Amazing.
Grandpa Ray, by the way, had been at game 7 of the 1945 World Series against the Tigers.
Unbelievable. If you had any doubts of his Midwest bona fides, there you go. All right. Favorite Chicago deep dish pizza chain?
Oh, Malnati's.
There we go. Malnati's, I will say, for our more national listeners than Chicago, has a very good frozen delivery option where you can get it on Gold Belly. I highly recommend it. Favorite New York City restaurant to go to when you come back into town?
ABC Kitchen.
Nice. Right around the corner.
It was right around the corner. Our old stomping grounds.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to pop in for a little beet salad before I go to bed.
That place is fantastic. All right. Favorite cocktail on a Friday after a long and arduous week?
Water.
I love it. 2022-2023 season outlook for Indiana hoops.
I've been told we're supposed to be good, but being raised a Cubs fan, you get used to just being beaten down. So everybody's telling us we're supposed to be like top 20. And so that means we're probably going to go like 0-15.
Favorite movie ever? Bonus points if it's set in Chicago.
Favorite movie ever? Boy, that's a good one. I'm trying to get an appropriate one.
I will say for our listeners, while he's thinking, we do a Thursday movie quote contest every week, and Fenster is a perennial winner. So he's got too many to think from is probably the issue here.
You know, I'll be honest, like Office Space is hilarious.
I mean, it's an amazing movie. Yeah, I think that's appropriate. We'll allow it. Fantastic. Thank you for the speed round. With that then, Mike, let's move to the last segment of the podcast. It's something we like to call Best Ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives recently. We call it Best Ideas because it's our goal as investors to always maximize exposure to those. Mike, you're a guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
You know, it's election season, and I am a big fan of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Dave Wasserman. So I think it can cut through the noise that we sometimes have to wade through when you try to get some information about where certain races are heading. And I think the political environment within the United States is something we should keep an eye on because there can be significant changes depending on who's in power.
Fantastic. The Cook Political Report. Is that a newsletter? Is that a, what service is that?
If you follow them on Twitter, that is free.
Okay.
If you want to subscribe, I think it can be $35 a month.
There you go. Great idea. All right. As listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guests of the week. As we've heard, Fenster is a Midwest guy through and through, has lived in Chicago for many years. He's also a big sports fan, lives and dies by the Cubs, etc. And so I started thinking about a TV show set in Chicago that I somehow feel like flew below the radar a little bit. My best idea this week is the criminally underrated TV show, The League. Originally, it was aired in FX in the early 2010s. It's now streamable on Hulu. The League is about a group of men and women that are in this fantasy football league and sort of all the nonsense around it. Its main stars have all gone on to great heights. They have incredible performances by the likes of Nick Kroll, Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas, Mark Duplass. But it's the guest stars that are insane, with everyone from Seth Rogen to Brie Larson making an appearance during its actual 7 seasons, which is kind of amazing. It's semi-improvised, like its core cast are all improv types. It's incredibly funny. Fair warning, it's wildly irreverent. Like, this is a mildly not safe for work recommendation, but I promise you would enjoy it if you don't care about football, fantasy, or otherwise. So in honor of a great Chicagoan and a great sports fan, let me offer up the TV show The League, available on Hulu now. Mike, any views on the show The League?
I know what I'm going to be watching on my flight home.
There you go. That's the next one. All right, Mike, with that, it's time to say goodbye for the week. It's always great to catch up. It's a pleasure hearing all you're up to and look forward to chatting again soon.
It's been my pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.